Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jerry Stahl, whose latest novel is Painkillers. Earlier novels, I, Fatty, and Perv, a Love Story, and author of the memoir Permanent Midnight. Jerry Stahl, let's talk a little about Painkillers, which posits that Joseph Mengele is still alive, and it's kind of a version of what his life would be like at the very end with a detective searching for him. What brought you to write this particular tale?
What brought me was in the middle of the later stages of the Bush administration and the many things that were being done in our name to non-white people all over the world. I was researching and I realized that much of Mengele's more heinous death camp, quote-unquote, medical experiments were financed by the Rockefeller Foundation and America's eugenics past and the assumption of Aryan supremacy seemed to be as much in play now as it was then on many levels. And it was a way in for me to sort of write about that under the guise of writing about Mengele and history.
The book has a great deal of research in it, particularly about some of the atrocious acts that were committed, and they're so far out that I was having trouble. I was thinking, is this more Jerry Stahl slapstick? But perhaps not.
I don't know that slapstick is the word I would use. What's truly terrifying is that this is one of those subjects that does not really require embellishment. The fact that when Mengele, for example, was doing research on turning brown eyes into the Aryan-approved blue, he would send the eyes to an institute in Berlin from Auschwitz, and that transport and investigation was paid for by American money. That was the more salient point for me. That is even more horrifying in a way than the actual experiments. For me, it came down to the kind of theory that country and border and that whole notion of nationalism is really kind of a con, and that the only country that's in charge is the country of the super rich and the super invested in just exploitation for their own benefit, and that transcends boundaries and borders. You know, if you read a book like the great Chris Hedges' book, American Fascists, you know, the premise upon which many of these born-again and conservative right-thinking institutions are based, it's supposedly morality and it's supposedly uplifting and for the soul. But what they're doing is getting people to vote for them so they can screw them later. So, big news, right?
There seems to be then, through your work, a political tack that's just under the surface. How conscious are you, particularly in writing for television and knowing how many people are going to see it, that there is a political element to your work?
That's a great question. I'm very conscious of it. I've always believed that on some level you can hide a lot by, quote-unquote, writing something that's humorous. My work is often dismissed as entertainment, but for me it's almost a Trojan horse because, you know, you write something funny, you write something engaging, but particularly in this book, there's a lot in there that perhaps in the hands of another author would have done just as a straight book or a straight-up research book. But for me, it's more effective to sort of meld the two.
You have the contrast between the humor, the over-the-top humor, and then the horror.
Over the top is such a relative term. I'm always asked, well, how can you write about subjects that are so dark and so revolting? And it's like, well, read the New York. You want noir? Read the New York Times. Read what we're doing all over the world. That's pretty noir.
When people question about writing jokes about the Nazis or the Holocaust, well, what about, you know, Mel Brooks did it years ago. This is nothing new.
One of the greatest things that I ever found out about Hitler is that he was never terrified of being assassinated. His biggest fear was being laughed at. And I actually talked to a couple survivors, and there's actually a website of humor and the Holocaust. And the theory that they sort of operate under is that if you live a life informed by the tragedy of that event, they win. And if you can transcend with a kind of humor above and beyond that, they don't win.
What about something like Life is Beautiful, which I found to be a fraud?
I was thoroughly repelled by that movie. I think it's sort of the principle that operates and is why Jerry Lewis never released The Day the Clown Cried, about the clown entertaining the children on the way to the ovens. The most offensive element to me about the Life is Beautiful is you can make it funny, but don't make it cute. Cute to me is the ultimate obscenity in that context.
You did a lot of research, Jerry Stahl, on painkillers, and there's a whole section, it's a very funny section, about Hasidism.
My close encounter with Hasidism was there is a section in the Fairfax District in Los Angeles where they, once a year, they have kind of a dance in the street where they sort of raise money and try to convert and this and that. And I, while completely strung out of my mind on the way to COP, I got swept into doing the hora on the street. The hora, as Joseph Conrad would say. And, you know, they put a hat on my head and danced me around. And that was my first indication. But, you know, when you move to Los Angeles and you're driving down the street and it's like 102 degrees and you see these guys in the fur hats and the coats, it's a pretty intriguing sight and, you know, no different in Brooklyn, just not as hot in Brooklyn.
You also did research on bulimia and Nazi sex fetishes.
Yes. I think it's good to have hobbies. Bulimia is fascinating to me because I once read the statistic that once television was introduced to Bhutan, the country of Bhutan, within a year, 60% of the young girls had eating disorders. So bulimia, to me, is sort of the American national disease, rather prevalent. As for Nazi sex fetishes, God bless the Internet. You know, the only thing more terrifying than the Joseph Mengele fan sites, I think, were the amazing amount of Nazi sex toys and Nazi sex fetishes. And, in fact, they designed a toy to be sent to the troops in the front lines that the men could have when they couldn't get to the local whorehouse.
What do you think it is about the whole Nazi thing that brings up the whole sexual element? I mean, you can go back to Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS, which was a movie around 20 years ago.
And you know what the interesting thing about that is? It was shot on the set of Hogan's Heroes on weekends. Put that in your brain. I think we have a real, we being America, has a real love affair, secret illicit love affair with the other and the verboten, that there's an element of self-hate involved, that, you know, they love the degradation of being stomped on by Ilsa. You know, I always have this image in my brain while I was writing of, you know, sort of Dick Cheney, hairless on his hands and knees, you know, getting whipped by Eva Braun lookalikes. Perhaps that's a sequel.
It's not surprising that a lot of these evangelicals have these secret sex lives.
Anybody who spends their whole time railing against one thing is generally obsessed and driven by it. And another element of the book is the Bush-induced abstinence sex movement, which was fascinating to me because you'd read the statistics. You know, I have a daughter, so, you know, I'm aware of what happens when girls go to high school and go through puberty. And the interesting thing about the abstinence movement was that they would maintain their virginity, but they would do everything else. And so they got all manner of herpes and just heinous diseases all over their bodies, but
they remained virgins.
There you go.
In writing a book like Painkillers, maybe it's in the rewrite, but obviously when you're letting your brain just flow with whatever comes, you're going to hit material that winds up offensive. You're going to hit material that winds up in bad taste. At what point do you kind of go back and go, well, this I'll do, but this kind of crosses the line? I mean, there's got to be some kind of censor there at some point, and it's got to be from you.
If it's gratuitous in the sense that I'm adding on or piling on, because with a subject like this, it's offensive because reality is offensive, and the truth is rather off-putting and quote-unquote over the top. But if you pull back to make nice, then you're in Life is Beautiful territory.
Better err on the side of going over the top than cutting back for fear.
Over the top is your phrase. To me, it's the truth, and that might seem over the top, but obviously I have no illusions this is going to be a bestseller and replace Marley and Me on the bestseller list. So, you know, this is just something I have to live with.
There are also a lot of in-jokes. The main character, Manny, is hired by a guy named Harry Zell, and I kept thinking of Jack Benny's old cohort, Harry Von Zell. Was that in your brain?
It's even more demented than that. I didn't realize unconsciously until I happened to see the Marathon Man at like 4 in the morning on cable that Laurence Olivier's character, who was a Mengele-like guy, was named Zell. And also, I have a lot of friends who work for the LA Times, which has recently been going into complete bankruptcy and firing everybody and her brother, and that is run by a man named Zell. So it was my little homage.
There's also another homage, and I'm not sure how deliberate that is, but you have a character toward the end of the book who gets murdered. We kind of never really find out who did it, and that reminded me of Chandler.
Yeah, I love Chandler because they would ask him about his plots and say, what are you asking me for? I have no idea what the hell happened. I had an idea who did it, but, you know, I figure it's good to leave him guessing.
There's one piece of coincidence that kind of stopped me, which is a character meets a woman on a plane, and then he's searching for one woman in all of L.A., and it turns out to be that woman.
Well, he's searching for one woman in all of L.A., but he has a clue who she is and a clue where she lives. That may be more a function of my lack of artfulness as a thriller writer, because I am not by nature a genre guy, but I hung this story on the thing that publishers and interviewers and writers like to do, which is, you know, categorize your work. Because, I mean, Crime and Punishment is a thriller. Not that I'm putting myself in that category. But he probably had more idea about what the hell his characters were doing than I did.
What made you decide to move in this particular direction? Was it just the Mengele thing and you're being angry about George Bush, or that you wanted to try your hand at a different kind of novel?
Well, I'm flattered by the implication that as an author, I know what I'm doing. The books kind of find you. I had wanted to write about Mengele, but I started a book, and after about 50 pages, I realized that, you know, my last book was I, Fatty, and it was like one wrong move, and I'm writing I, Mengele, which I don't think the public was really crying out for. So I kind of married it to the prison-centric book, because I'm also obsessed with America's fetish for prison porn on MSNBC on the weekends when it's not Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann.
Which is an element of the book, America's Obsession. What do you think that has to do with? I mean, we've imprisoned more people than anyone else around the world. I mean, it's
not only have we imprisoned them, but now they're our entertainment. I think it works on two levels. One, there are so few people left for, like, Joe Front Porch to feel superior to that at least he can turn on the tube, you know, sit there, watch these guys in the joint and think, well, at least I'm not there. And second, I think there's kind of a homoerotic element where, like, your basic Midwest Gus or Bernie is just sitting around, you know, watching these buff, tattooed, boxer shorts wearing convicts kind of like strutting around the yard, and they can watch that and kind of get off it. And then when her wife comes in and says, honey, what are you doing? It's like, well, I'm not gay. I'm just watching these, you know, big half-naked strapping killers. But it's MSNBC. You know, it's legit.
Well, it takes it one step beyond Oz and Prison Break.
Yeah, because it's the real deal. You know, they're not even pretending to have a plot. You're just looking at these guys walking around and talking.
Let's move slightly in a different direction.
Sure.
Speaking of television there, what do you think of the way reality shows have destroyed scripted programs?
First of all, there is kind of a lie built into that whole genre because they are scripted. You know, it's not like there isn't a cameraman standing by and a script supervisor and they're creating these bogus situations. I mean, I've talked to a couple filmmakers in my day who've done documentaries, and like the great Terry Zwigoff, he and I worked on something together. And, you know, he said there's more directing involved in a documentary than there is in a feature movie. So I think the notion that it is, quote, reality is perhaps what they would like you to believe.
And there's also the editing, too.
The editing, but you do pay less people, straight up. You don't have to pay actors. And there's people clamoring to make idiots of themselves, so that cuts out the casting call.
A number of scenes in Painkillers take place in San Quentin. Have mm-hmm. you been there?
Yeah, I taught there. I don't know if you know a documentary filmmaker named Bruce Sanofsky. He did the Metallica documentary, Some Kind of Monster. He did My Brother's Keeper. He did Paradise Lost about the Memphis Three. He ran a thing called San Quentin Film School. So for 2 days, I went in there and taught on camera, which was a little bizarre, some of the inmates who wanted to learn how to write. And I ended up just listening to them more than they listened to me.
Were you given files similar to the files that Manny gets?
No, I had no idea what they were accused of. And it is not good etiquette to ask. But in the course of hearing, because I would always ask them, well, if you made a movie of your life, what kind would it be? And one old guy who was like about 80 and in there for life said, porno. You know, the really tragic thing is that, innocent or guilty, most of these guys were in blackouts of one kind or another, alcoholic or narcotic, and They didn't deny their crime. They just didn't remember it, and they felt horrible about what they did. You know, it wasn't like they planned a heist or took something over. They were just guys in the wrong place at the wrong time with bad lawyers, you know?
The guards and painkillers seem as nuts as the prisoners.
Well, they're nuts enough to be the second most powerful labor organization in California and to pretty much control Schwarzenegger. Beyond that, I think you cannot live in any environment like that and not have the reality leak in. And I think it must attract a certain kind of man to wield that power all day.
For me, reading about San Quentin, since I'm driving from the East Bay over to to Marin, I'm driving right past San Quentin almost on a daily basis. And it's a very odd feeling because on the one hand, you've got Larkspur and the new condos on the hill. And then on the other hand, you've got guys doing hard time just literally feet away.
If you didn't know it was San Quentin and you just saw it from a certain blurry distance, could it not be some old school resort?
You've also got Alcatraz, and the two of them kind of look like bookends, you know?
Yeah, that's so true.
You know, the two towers of Sauron, you know?
That's well put, yeah. Well, what's really interesting, right outside, there's this sort of charming little couple of rows of bungalows and white picket fences, and it just looks like, wow, here we are in anywhere USA, you know, with Charlie Manson around the corner.
When you did your classes, you didn't have to stay in trailers or anything. You left, right?
No, I left. My favorite thing was the gift shop, which is where the guy said, have a nice day. I can't, because he was a trustee who had been there forever. You know, the little gewgaws that they sell when they sign their prisoner number. And you realize that if you've ever been in a motel with that really cheesy art of like the seashore and the waves crashing, I don't know if they all come from San Quentin, but it's like an art gallery of like cheesy motel art. I guess that's as close to nature as those guys get.
When you're trying to get toward the end of a book like Painkillers, you've got everything set up. How scared are you that it won't pull together?
Boy, that terror begins long before you get to the end of the book. You just sort of operate on this high wire and try not to look down, because not only won't it come together, but you always wonder if the whole endeavor is making any sense to anyone but you, and you're so close, you're seeing words, you're not seeing the whole thing. I have that crippling disease where I could spend 5 hours perfecting a sentence and not realize that the whole chapter is incoherent, you know? Sure, that is one of many terrors, that it won't come together, but I generally start with an ending scene. I don't know how I'm going to get there, but I have an image in my head of where it's all somehow, some way going to end up.
That's different than working on a script, because in the script you've got acts and breaks.
My God, script, it's connect the dots, but the hard part is you got to put the dots down.
For a while there, I was watching a lot of pre-code films, and the thing I noticed about pre-codes is that on top of the fact that it was in those days, one of the more amazing things is that these films did not operate under the premise of the way we usually see a screenplay played out. So you never know where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. And it's really refreshing.
It is refreshing. I think there's a mentality now that there is a prescribed ending that will bring satisfaction. Like, you want the villain to have this happen, and you know this is going to happen. And it's really antithetic, I think, to what great fiction and great art does, which is surprise you. Because the surprises in movies, if I think I understand you, they're the ones that are sort of expected. Right. And in those pre-code films, it's just like a power cord that's, you know, a power line that's gone down in a storm, and it's flashing, you know, thrashing around. You never know where it's going to hit. It's really exciting to watch those movies.
Domestic drama could turn into a comedy and then into a murder mystery
that. That's right. And now, as it is in publishing, as it is in theater, as it is in music, everything is market-driven, and they must categorize. Like this book of mine, for better or worse, being marketed as a mystery, which I guess it is, and a thriller. But to me, it's just like fiction is fiction, man.
Manny in Painkillers has certain characteristics of yours. What do you think those are?
Well, he's fictional, so there's that. I think the characteristics are basically, I'm always attracted about characters, you know, in real life and in books who have been to hell. You know, I'm kind of a pain snob. I don't really trust anybody who hasn't been to hell. And you can kind of look in people's eyes and tell. So there's a certain worldview, whatever the specifics of the circumstance, there's a certain worldview of people who've been through it for better or worse and come back that always appeals to me. You know, the story's all the way back to Dante. I mean, you know, you go to the underground and you claw your way out.
The character of Manny is Hep C. A friend of mine has Hep C and is dealing with the whole interferon. I have two friends dealing with it right now, and that's apparently comes out of usually drugs.
Yeah, I have Hep C, too. I haven't done interferon because I don't like the odds. With my genome, it's 30 to 50% success. But that's me. I mean, some people it works, some people it doesn't. I go the Chinese medicine sort of diet, Qigong route, but that's me. Do not have great faith in Western medicine because they told me I had a year to live 11 years ago. And, you know, I never went back to that doctor.
There's a quote on the front of the book. Jerry Stahl should either get the Pulitzer Prize or be shot down in the street like a dog, from Anthony Bourdain. How do you know Anthony Bourdain?
We used to have some of the same hobbies, same bad habits back in the day. And he's a friend. And I really, really love his book, Kitchen Confidential.
Going back to those days, the ones who are alive, do you ever see them like suddenly becoming more successful and turning their lives around, and you kind of go, wow, I knew you on the street?
Well, that happens. I mean, I had a friend, hardcore convict and dope fiend named Eddie Little, who I had worked with, and he published a book called Another Day in Paradise that was made into a movie with James Woods by Larry Clark. And he couldn't handle the success, because when you're a junkie and when you're, you know, kind of used to living that criminal life on the street, you're always fighting on your back. And he ended up movie deals and money, and he checked into a motel room, OD'd and died. Success is not always success, if that makes any sense.
In the days before the events of Permanent Midnight, during those days, you were writing for a lot of TV shows, including Twin Peaks, Moonlighting, Northern Exposure.
You're flattering me. I was fired from all the best shows. I think I will have on my tombstone, he only wrote three ALFs, because every time I do an interview, it's like, oh, you're the guy who created ALF. It's like, I wish. I would own you now. I basically slept my way to the middle. I married a woman who, for $3,000, needed a green card, who worked in TV and got me a couple gigs, but it was a short-lived run. But because I wrote about it in a book, I actually spent a lot more time being homeless and stealing televisions and other stuff.
During those early days, what exactly did you do for Twin Peaks?
I wrote a script. I was the last person in L.A. that didn't have a computer, so I basically turned in a script with, like, cat hair and liquid paper and blood stuck to it and got fired instantly. But somehow my name ended up in the script. I always wanted to be a novelist. I had no idea. I'd never been to film school. I just fell stumbling backwards down the stairs into television writing, and I would get the job and then instantly lose it. So it sounds a bit more like I was a success than the reality is.
When you finally did see that Twin Peaks, was there any resemblance between the original script?
Oh, God, no. You know, they hire producers specifically to rip the pages up and throw them in your face and rewrite them. That's, I think, their job.
When you came back from your long, dark, Permanent Midnight and got back into the film industry, you became friends with Ben Stiller.
Well, that's how I ended up back in the movies. I literally, he did play me in Permanent Midnight, and the money fell out. So there was about a year there where it wasn't happening. But we had met the first time, and he just said, out of the blue, do you want to write a movie of What Makes Sammy Run, the great Bud Schulberg novel? So I had never even written a movie script. I didn't even know where to put the margins. But so I went from just sort of being recently homeless and now more or less living in a, you know, little one-room place, to flying with Stiller on some private jet to St. Bart, eating like Sly Stallone's leftover tuna fish sandwiches, you know. So it was a bit of a culture shock. But I just fell into it.
How hard or easy was it to work on those scripts then?
You know, everybody will always tell you that scripts are so much easier than novels, but for me, they're very, very hard for a couple of reasons. One thing, when you write a novel, for better or worse, it's just you. When you write a script, there's generally some committee of 11 people saying, we love it, but just change the main character to a 9-year-old Chinese girl and set it in Bosnia, you know? Also, it's much more architecture, much more plotting, much more of a blueprint-type process, which if you've had that part of your brain burned out, as I have, is rather tricky. So I'm brought in a lot of times to just kick up dialogue.
Well, when you say kick up dialogue, what will they, can you give an example of
a real
example,
film? There was a movie, I don't want to brag, a little art house sleeper called Bad Boys 2 that came out a few years ago. And, you know, they brought me in to just sort of fix the dialogue and kind of make it a little realer, a little funnier. You know, I'm one of like 16 guys they will bring in to do that.
When you saw the film, did you hear your own words?
Here and there. Hello, goodbye. Thank you.
How'd you get the gig with CSI, and what did that consist of?
I joined the Hollywood YMCA a long time ago because I didn't have a place to live and I needed a place to shower. So I used to continue to go there, and one day I'm sitting in the sauna and in comes Billy Peterson, who was a movie actor at the time, who said, you know, kind of not happening in the movies now. And so we got to talking, and his daughter had read something of mine or whatever, and he said, I'm going to be doing a TV show in a couple of years. Would you have any interest? So against all odds, it was one of the few naked encounters in Hollywood that actually resulted in gainful employment. And he called me, and, you know, we became friends, and that's how I got onto the show.
What did you do for them?
I was a consultant, and I came up with sort of the more extremo episodes, you know, furries, plushies, adult infantilism, fetishistic corset wearing, you know, the usual stuff.
So you were not exactly involved in the plotting, per se.
Well, you had to break stories, but, you know, my plot muscle was pretty pathetic. You know, the great thing about writing a novel is you, instead of going from like A to Z, you go to A25 and just embellish to the left or right. So I can do that. I'm a good guy for flavor, but I'm not great for getting all the ingredients.
Now you're working on this feature for HBO about Ernest Hemingway. How did that come about?
I'd worked with Philip Kaufman before, and he gave me a call. There are certain loyalties you form in this business, because when you work on projects, particularly ones that don't get made, it's like your little Vietnam. It's an interesting subject, because when Hemingway married this woman, Martha Gellhorn, who was a war journalist, who was actually a better war journalist than he was, so it's less the macho Hemingway of story than the real kind of challenge of a man finding his equal in a woman and dealing with it.
In terms of your own research, do you think there's any difference between, I'll give you the three examples, writing for iFatty, about Fatty Arbuckle, writing for about Mengele, or writing about Hemingway? Is it all pretty much the same kind of research?
Research is research, and I'm not one of those people who feels that, like, there's this big discrepancy between genres. To me, you know, trying to get to the heart of a character and come out with some kind of emotional reality transcends the genre. I realize how pretentious that's going to sound, but that's how it is for me. I think I would blow my brains out if I just had to write cocktail napkins for a living, but God knows I've done worse for less.
In a book like I, Fatty, in essence, you can both go off on your own a little bit more and at the same time be truer to it.
Exactly, yeah. I, Fatty was a blessing, because I didn't have, you know, there is a plot. You know, what I had to come up with was a device and a way into his character that in some way sounded authentic, and I hope was to a degree authentic.
And that's supposed to be a movie with Johnny Depp?
He optioned it. Stranger things have happened. Well, it wouldn't be him. We had talked to Philip Seymour Hoffman, so who knows? You know, things get optioned, and sometimes they break, and sometimes they don't.
Working on a biopic, which is what the Hemingway thing is, coming up with an idea that isn't the simple, straightforward Hollywood biopic.
Yeah, exactly. It's a brutal genre, because there are so many ways to do it badly, and so many examples of that. Plus, you kind of want to honor the life. You don't want to just cheese out. So it's tricky. It's a very tricky thing.
Is there a particular approach you're taking that you can talk about?
The approach, to me, involves not just the level of the personal and the characters, but a lot of it takes place in the Spanish Civil War, about which most people know nothing. So there's that element where, without being didactic, you're trying to kind of educate and inform and explain the context at the same time you're talking about the characters. So that's something I haven't confronted before. The great thing about Kaufman, for me, he's like a mentor, and, you know, you're dealing with a guy who, you know, at the end of the day is going to make you smarter than you really are, and that's not always the case, to put it mildly, working in Hollywood.
Speaking about Hollywood, I was reading something today or yesterday in online newspaper about how Hollywood executives, after seeing the success of the Paul Blart movie, seem to think that people don't want intelligent films anymore. And I'm like, it's one movie in one winter.
Yeah, I don't know that, you know, audiences have ever been out there clamoring for high IQ entertainment. But, you know, at the same time, I'm not going to hop on the bandwagon and say that's a stupid movie. It's not the easiest thing in the world to make people laugh, because there are a lot of really insipidly bad, unfunny comedies. Don't ask me why, but while trapped in a hotel room at 4 in the morning, I watched Paul Blart. You know, there's some funny stuff in it. It's... in the grand tradition of, you know, Jackie Gleason or fat guys falling off the stage everywhere. So, you know, I tend not to be a snob about that stuff.
What about politics and Hollywood? There's an adage that it doesn't matter what it is as long as it makes money. So they're perfectly willing to bankroll a film like Reds or Fahrenheit 9/11. Doesn't matter to them. It's going to make money.
I think what a lot of people don't know, and I do believe this to be true, is that a lot of the money behind, you know, Fahrenheit came from Mel Gibson, oddly enough. So, you know, a lot of strange bedfellows in Hollywood.
There seems to be a lot of play about a new right-wing resurgence among Hollywood people. Is that something you see, or is that just the newspapers trying to build something up?
I have never seen that, but, you know, even quote-unquote left-wing, it doesn't really leak into the films that much. I mean, it's pretty comfortable and easy to be left-wing when you're living in Bel Air or Brentwood or Beverly Hills or any other of the affluent neighborhoods that start with a B. You know, I don't know that anybody starts with a political agenda and operates from there, but it does inform your work, and I don't see a lot of particularly political films being made. Maybe I'm missing something.
In dealing with Hollywood and knowing that you lived a rather different life from the people in Hollywood, does that give you a kind of sense of humor about everything they do where you can't really take it seriously?
Well, I've had the great good fortune, and I always say this to people, you know, when you go to writing classes and stuff, and they say, what do you recommend? I always say, destroy your life, and then start writing. I mean, I didn't get a book published until I was 42. I was a failure and a loser and an outcast much more than I was my borderline success that I have now. So, yeah, I take it with a grain of salt. I mean, once you've had a gun pointed to your head on the corner of crack and eight ball, you're not going to be particularly intimidated by some producer spewing at you over, like, two lines that he hates.
How do you deal with that? You just kind of inside laugh and at the front say, yes, sir?
Well, yeah, it's like that, you know, an invisible man when Ralph Ellison writes about his grandfather giving him the best advice on how to deal with the white man. It was just yes him to death. I don't take it that seriously. You know, it can be hard when you write the same script over and over 300 times. But you know what? Hard is digging a ditch and supporting a family of 10, so I can't really bitch.
Jerry Stahl, what are you working on now? Beside the HBO, you working on another book?
I have to go till in the fields for a while, so I'm working on a couple other movies. I'm doing a Will Smith thing based on this book called Cooked by a chef, Jeff Henderson, who was a guy who was a crack cooker, very famous for years in San Diego. He did 10 years federal time, learned how to be a chef, became the first African-American executive chef in Vegas, and has his own show. So I'm writing that and just did a movie. I don't know, did you ever see a movie called The Devil and Daniel Johnston, the documentary?
No.
It won at Sundance for Best Documentary. But anyway, I'm writing a movie with the guy who directed that based on the true story of Chuck Webner, known as the Bayonne Bleeder, who Rocky stole his life, basically. Stallone made a movie called Rocky based on a sort of a cleaned-up version of this guy's life. So he got the life rights to the really insane, demented story of this guy's life. He ended up doing time for cocaine himself and then seeing Stallone shooting a movie in the penitentiary, living the success based on his own life. So it's a very bizarre true story. So I've ended up being biopic guy, so I'm doing a few of those.
Do you work on them at the same time?
I have to. It just shakes down that way. You know, I have a daughter in college, and it's not cheap these days, and not complaining. You know, it's like running up a down escalator as fast as you can to stay right in the middle, you know. For me, when I get to write a novel, it's just, you know, I really try to just saturate myself in it and try to do a couple years' work in 6-10 months.
You're also working on a screenplay about Oscar Levant.
Ben Stiller bought the rights to Oscar Levant. So Oscar Levant, for those who don't know, while Lenny Bruce and all these people were supposedly the cutting-edge drug guys, Oscar Levant was a mainstream entertainer. He was a best-selling musician. He worked with Gershwin, a composer. He was in all those movies as the coffee-drinking pianist who with the cigarette butts out on the saucer. But he also had his own talk show while living in a mental hospital. So he would take an ambulance to the studio every day, wherein in the 50s he would talk about getting electroshock and talk about how much he loved Dilaudid and how much he loved tranquilizers. And he was publicly breaking down in an era when everybody was keeping their suits very well buttoned. And he was famous for his quips, like, I knew Doris Day before she was a virgin, and beneath this flabby exterior lies a complete lack of character. This was something I just loved and completely related to the guy. So, again, we'll see if it gets made, but he was the definitive true Hollywood hipster.
Is there anybody intended for the lead? Would that be Stiller?
That would be Stiller.
What about the idea of, it's edgy, let's give it to Stahl? Any of those lately?
You know, as soon as I hear the word edgy, I just run the other direction at this point. Because, you know, Hollywood's idea of edgy is not mine. And when I give them what I think is edgy, they don't just reject it. They spray the couch cushions with Raid after I leave. You come in and they, you know, they want some dark idea. You know, we want to do a real-life story about, like, a drug addict. And, you know, the typical thing they want is somebody who destroys their home and, you know, loses their family, you know, and I tell them, like, the real deal of what it's like, which is clawing your way into other people's houses at 3 a.m. and waking up in strange places and getting diseases like Hep C. And they want to glamorize. And the reality is that, you know, being a dope fiend is only glamorous if you think puking on your shoes is glamorous. So I don't even go up for those gigs anymore.
Jerry Stahl, you've also written a lot of short stories, and you have a collection of stories. How does writing short stories compare to writing a novel?
I think it's harder to write a short story in a way. The collection that came out were they were old stories. They collected from like 20 and 30 years ago. I haven't done many recently. But the thing about a short story is it's like a jewel, as I'm sure you've heard, and you've just got to polish it and make it perfect, and every sentence matters. In a book, you can kind of sprawl and ramble and digress and embellish. So for a man with no attention span like myself, a short story is much more challenging.
How about writing a play?
I wrote a play many years ago that got put up on Sunset Boulevard in a theater. I would love to, because my motto is fail in all genres. You know, that's what I'm going for.
Well, how about a musical version of Permanent Midnight?
Funny you should say that. City Lights is sponsoring an event at a bar called Amnesia. And apparently, I have been told, there will be an improv troupe acting out scenes from Permanent Midnight, so that should be festive.
You've been listening to an interview with Jerry Stahl, whose latest novel is Painkillers. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.